You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also designs and hosts Virginia history programs for the Charlottesville Senior Center. In the fall of 2010, the Senior Center offered one of Rick's programs entitled Virginia History 101. Running from October 7th through November 18th, this six-session lecture series was designed for those interested in Virginia's fascinating early history. On October 7th, 2010, Rick Britton himself delivered a talk on the Monacan Nation. Controlling most of the Virginia Piedmont, the Monacan Indians made war against Tidewater's Powhatan Nation, established five major villages, grew corn, and hunted deer, elk, and bison. Unfortunately, all that remains of this elusive people are remnants of their tools, knives, and projectile points. This is the first in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Rick Britton.
It was Whit Sunday, May 24th, 1607, just 11 days after the Englishmen had planted their banner on the marshy Jamestown Peninsula. Spurred onward by the London Company directives, ex-privateer captain Christopher Newport had taken a party of 23 ocean-weary adventurers upriver on a voyage of discovery. Gabriel Archer was riding the two-masted shallop as official scribe. Shallop is the kind of boat they had. Gunner Robert Tyndall had gone along to chart the tidal river's many twists and turns. After 3 days of navigating the powerful flow, the explorers had arrived at the falls, almost 60 miles upstream from their newly established settlement. Here, over the course of several miles, the rushing current roared around huge rocks, and it still does if you know the spot that I'm talking about, loudly proclaiming its dominance over the solemn wooded hills. Blocked from proceeding further, the small English vessel was quickly moored against the left bank. For a handful of tiny bells and trinkets, Nowrus, an Aborigine guide, had described what lay to the west of this navigational bar: two mighty kingdoms and the mountains Quirank. Perhaps those highland regions would yield the gold Newport desired, and perhaps, just perhaps, the South Sea lay just beyond. While matchlock-wielding mariners looked on, Newport laid out a banquet for the mighty Indian Werowances, or chiefs. And we'll go over some of these names. I know I'm using a lot of Indian names. And, you know, when we get to the towns, I'm just going to be guessing, as anybody else does, at the proper pronunciation when we get to these towns. Out of the woods they came, these chiefs, wearing mantles of raccoon fur and copper, escorted by numbers of fighting men with painted faces and strangely cut manes. At the coming of Powhatan, Nowrus made sign to us we must make a shout, penned Archer, which we did, and the feast of roasted wildfowl and venison began. Now sitting upon the bank of the overfall, Powhatan began to tell us of the tedious travel we should have if we proceeded any further, that it was a day and a half journey to Monanica, and if we went to Quirank, the mountains Quirank, we should get no victuals and be tired, and sought by all means to dissuade our captain from going any further. Also, he told us that the Monanica was his enemy, and that they came down at the fall of the leaf and invaded his country, continues Archer's account. But our captain, out of his discretion, though he would fain have gone further, yea, and himself as desirous also, you got to love this language from the early 1600s. Our captain checked his intention and returned to his boat. Discouraged from further exploration at that time, the Englishmen unfettered their craft and fell back downstream. But not until Captain Newport had planted a cross on one of the many islets below the falls and christened the river as the James, in honor of the extravagant James I, King of all England and Scotland. Thus did the sons of Europe first learn of the Monanica, or Monacan, nation, a confederacy of Native Americans that dominated the Virginia Piedmont, living under the protective shadows of the Quirank, the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. Who were these potent Monacans, so feared by the Powhatans? Where had they come from? Where did they live? How did they live? Where did they go? Unfortunately, they left behind no written records, and little, very, very little, has been written about them. But the frequent finds of large numbers of projectile points, knives, tools, etc., noted Joseph Ringers, continue to arouse curiosity about the life and customs of these elusive peoples. It has been estimated that as many as 15 to 20,000 natives populated the Old Dominion up through the early years of the 18th century. And just the other day, I saw a historian who claims that perhaps as many as 50,000 Native Americans were in Virginia at that time. Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1780 that these aborigines were composed of upwards of 40 different tribes. The most powerful were the Powhatans, the Manahoacs, and here you're going to have to excuse my pronunciation, Manahoacs, and the Monacans, and we're going to go over where they lived on this map in just a moment. Those between the seacoast and falls of the rivers were in amity with one another, penned the master of Monticello, and attached to the Powhatans as their link of union. Those between the falls of the rivers and the mountains were divided into two confederacies, the tribes inhabiting the headwaters of the Potomac and Rappahannock being attached to the Manahoacs. These divisions, marked by the limitations of navigation, however, were rather loosed and in constant dispute. For according to Jefferson, the Monacans and their friends were in amity with the Manahoacs and waged joint and perpetual war against the Powhatans to the east. Okay, so it's time to pass out some maps. Y'all who come on my trips, you know, I love maps. I'm a professional cartographer. Thank you. Now, this is a section, actually, it's most of the Captain John Smith map. We'll take a look at this and we'll do some orienteering. We'll figure out exactly where everything is on this so you'll be able to decipher it. Sure. Yeah, there's one for everybody. You got some extras? Thanks. One for Walt. Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for coming. Pretty good. One for Bev. And you got some more? Great. You got one for yourself? Okay. Did they? Okay. Okay, this is absolutely a fantastic map. This first appeared in print, and really it's only missing, oh, maybe an inch and a half on the bottom. So I was able to get most of it on this 11 by 17 sheet. First appeared in 1624. About the lower half of it was drawn from actual exploration, the upper half from information that Captain John Smith got from Native Americans. All right. Problem number one, west is to the top of the map, where north would normally be. Okay, so notice at the very bottom, you've got the Virginia Eastern Shore. See it? Then running left to right toward the bottom is the Chesapeake Bay. Does everybody see the Chesapeake Bay now? Okay. Now, let's find the James River. If you look at the widest part of the Chesapeake Bay, which is in the lower left-hand corner, remember west is to the top of the map. Look in the lower left-hand corner, and you'll see it says Powhatan Flume. That's the James River. See it? Okay, now follow it upstream through all those curves. It's the longest one, so make sure you stay on the longest one. There's the Chickahominy there. I see the Rappahannock just to the north of the James. Now you're coming up alongside this image of Powhatan in his cabin. You see that on the left upper left-hand corner? Follow the James, and just to the right of that, you'll see where it says the falls. Does everybody see that? Has everybody found that? The falls? Okay. The falls. Right, it's right there. Okay? That's where Richmond is today, the falls of the James River. The falls refers to the limit of navigation. So the falls of the Rappahannock are at Fredericksburg. So tidewater in Virginia is everything to the east of the fall line. So to the east of Richmond, to the east of Fredericksburg, that's tidewater, Virginia, the limit of navigation at the falls of those of the major rivers. Now, let's go beyond the falls. So we're going further west. And notice up here, in between the image of the Wererance, it's a very tough word to pronounce, Wererance or chieftain, and that scroll, you'll see the word Monacans. See them? To Western Virginia. Go beyond Monacans, and you'll see that the James River forks. Does everybody see it? Yeah. The fork that's to the right, that's the Rivanna River. And if you'll see the name of the town that's right near the Rivanna, there's one called Rassawek and another one called Manasookapanal. You see them? Okay, now that you know where those things are on here, and does everybody follow? Is everybody with me? Let's transfer it onto what I drew, okay? Okay, so I drew this earlier. I came in earlier. North is properly to the top. And we'll take a break after maybe 20 minutes, and the folks who can't see it in the back can come up and take a look. Can most of you see this, though, from the... Okay, great. All right. All right, the blue is the rivers. The blue are the Native American towns. The towns of the Europeans are in white. Okay, so here's the James River. At the time, though, that was called the Fluvanna River. Here's the Rivanna. The Rivanna and the Fluvanna come together at Columbia and form the James River. All right? Here's Richmond, and here's that turn to the south. Remember, the James River takes that turn, that bend to the south, right at Richmond. That's where the falls are, right there. Okay. We're going to talk about these towns. Let's see, what else do I need to tell you? Here are the Blue Ridge Mountains here. Okay, let's go through the story a little bit further. What I just related to you is that the Powhatans, probably the most powerful confederation in Virginia, three main confederacies. The most powerful one is the Powhatans. They controlled the tidewater. So everything east of the fall line, so from here all the way down to eastern Virginia, and the same from Fredericksburg along the Rappahannock, so that northern neck and that section right through here, controlled by the Powhatans. Then the Monacan area. The Monacan area is the upper James River Valley and the Rivanna Valley, River Valley. Think what a huge region that was. So this entire region right here, controlled by the Monacans. To their north, the Manahoacks. So above the fall line, so above Fredericksburg, so upriver on the Rappahannock and the Rapidan, this is the Manahoacks up here. A lot of people believe that actually the Manahoacks and the Monacan were in league together against the Powhatan. And that's one of the reasons the Powhatan feared the Monacan and tried to get Christopher Newport and his party of Englishmen to not go any further. They were afraid they'd go up there and find an allegiance up there with the Monacans than against them, which is almost what happened. The region controlled by the Monacans, therefore, was vast and fertile. It included the valleys of the James and Rivanna rivers and the fabulous country drained by their tributaries both north and south. The Indians and the early English colonists regarded it as a separate and distinct land. Sir Henry Peyton, writing about 1610, referred to the area as the land called the Monscane, M-O-N-S-C-A-N-E, Monscane. But a few years later, William Strachey revealed the primary European interest in the Monacan territory when he wrote that an early expedition found a highland woody with rising hills, rocky and mountainous. For minerals, we will promise nothing, but the hope of which, seeing the low ground, yields many fair shows. The mountains cannot be doubted, but that in them many sorts of minerals will be found. The biggest thing, of course, they want to find gold in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Failing to immediately find buried riches or the passage to the Pacific, remember they're actually thinking they'll find the passage to the South Seas, the armored Englishmen did discover that Monscane embraced at least five large villages, centers of the Indian population. Mohencho and Massanikak rested on the right bank of the James, and I'm going to point these out in just a moment, in present-day Powhatan County, while Rasawek in Fluvanna County, often called the Monacans' principal town or their headquarters, had been set up at or near the confluence of the James and the Rivanna. Farther up the James River, the ancient village of Monahassanu was built on the broad bottomland of the left bank in Nelson County, approximately 10 miles upstream from the mouth of the Rockfish River. Monasukapanow, and remember now, I'm just guessing at these pronunciations, and there's lots of different ways to spell all these names, so I'm just guessing. Monasukapanow in Albemarle County occupied both sides of the Rivanna River at a beautiful site 2 miles above its principal fork where a convenient ford made passage easy. So let's talk about these. Okay. Mohencho, M-O-W-H-E-M-C-H-O, Mohencho, later to be known as Monacan Town and today known as Manakin. Does that sound familiar? As you go down 64, was first encountered by Christopher Newport in 1608 in passing up the valley of the James River from the falls. Here it is right here, Mohencho. It stood on the right or south bank of the river and probably covered some of the land, some of the level area bordering the stream in the extreme eastern part of the present Powhatan County between Bernard's Creek on the east and Jones Creek on the west. It does not appear to have been a palisaded village, and we're going to talk some more about palisaded villages, but rather an open settlement. Gardens were probably near the scattered habitations. It was a beautiful site for a native village. On the north, it was protected by cliffs rising abruptly from the left bank of the river. On the south, it was bounded by high rolling land from which issued springs of clear water. Game was abundant throughout the region. And if you're familiar with the James River close to Richmond, it certainly is beautiful down there. 3 centuries ago, Mohencho was an important center, probably the home of some hundreds of individuals who lived in a land of plenty where food was easily obtained. How long the site may have been occupied will probably never be known. By the close of the 17th century, few Indians remained in the vicinity, and during the year 1699, a Huguenot colony took possession of the land and there established a settlement which continued for some years. He goes on to say that the Huguenot settlement was right next to it, and they probably coexisted with a few of the Monacan Indians for a few years. And here's a description from one of the Huguenots. in 1699, in their homes, and he's talking about the Monacans now, in their homes they are naked, as I have seen one at Mannequin Town, who came back from hunting. He had nothing but his gun, knife, and powder horn, except a linen rag which covered his sexual parts a little, and a deerskin protecting his feet, that the thorns might not hurt him. He had also a tuft of feathers behind his ear. I thought that was an interesting description. All right, as we go further up the James River, the next one up is Massanaquac. I think that's Massanaquac. Massanaquac was the second native village reached by Newport in 1608 after having entered the Monacan territory. Newport and his men later on went further up the James River. It is shown on the Smith map of 1624 as situated south of the James. That's the map that I passed out. Strachey mentioned it being some 14 miles distant from Mohenchco, so it's 14 miles upstream, or Monacan Town, which would place it on the right bank of the river about the mouth of the present Mohawk Creek, a mile or more south of the town of Goochland, on the opposite side of the James. During the 18th century, there was an important ferry across the James at or very near the site of this early native settlement. Leading southward from the ferry was a road over which colonists went to Carolina. So one of the main routes to the Carolinas across the James passed right at where this native settlement had been. As many of the roads developed by the first settlers follow the lines of ancient trails, it is within reason to believe the same route had been traversed by Indians throughout generations. And as we know, coming up from Richmond, the three-notch or three-chopped road had also been a Native American trail going from the Richmond area into the Shenandoah Valley. All right, next up is Rasawek. No account has been discovered of a European having visited the village of Rasawek. What a shame, huh? Although early writers referred to it as the principal town of the Monacan Confederacy. Smith wrote, Captain John Smith in 1612, upon the head of the Powhatans are the Monacans, whose chief habitation is at Rasawek. But all his knowledge of the place had been derived from the Indians. It stood evidently at the confluence of the James and the Rivanna. Of course, at that time, it was actually called the Fluvanna, as I mentioned earlier. Some miles beyond the point where Newport turned to retrace his way to Jamestown in the autumn of 1608. Viewed at the present time, and this was written, what I'm reading to you now was written in 1914, so the present time was almost 100 years ago. Viewed at the present time, the most desirable and logical location for an extensive village would have been on the right bank of the Rivanna, within the angle formed by the two streams. Here is a wide bottom with high rolling land a short distance from the James touching the Rivanna. When timbered and in its natural condition, this would have been a beautiful site for native settlement. Ironically, in the American Revolution, British, of course, controlled the coast, and, of course, the state of Virginia under Jefferson wanted to get goods and ammunition, military accoutrements and ammunition away from the coast because the British could raid it. So they established the largest depot for military items and for manufacturing military items and accoutrements at what's called today Point of Fork. So I think there's possibly a good chance that Point of Fork was built right on top of what would have been left in 1780, 1781 of the village of Rasawek. And Point of Fork then, of course, was captured not by Tarleton, but by the other gentleman who did a simultaneous raid. And von Steuben, the same guy who'd been the drill master at Valley Forge, retreated across the James River. The British captured it and burned Point of Fork to the ground. So possibly at that time, they also destroyed what might have still been around of Rasawek. Really quickly, Monahassanu. Monahassanu. The ancient village of Monahassanu is believed to have stood on the left bank of the James about 1.5 miles up the stream from Wingina in Nelson County. The river is here bordered on the north or left bank by broad, fertile bottomlands which extend for some miles above and below the site, while on the opposite side, cliffs rise abruptly, steep, rugged, and broken. The site resembles that of Mohemcho or Monacan Town, although the relative position of the cliffs and low ground is reversed, the former being on the left bank of the river and the latter, which was occupied by the village, on the right. Obviously, I'm leaving what I think is the most important one for the very last, right? Most scholars agree that the Monacan people, including their contributors, the Tutelo and Saponi tribes, spoke a Siouan language. And this absolutely fascinates me. Exactly when they first moved to the Virginia Piedmont will most likely forever remain a mystery. The earlier habitat of the Siouan tribes is believed to have been in the Valley of the Ohio, wrote archaeologist David Bushnell, from which region they crossed the mountains to the eastward. Some sources claim these early Sioux were driven over the Alleghenies by enemies farther to the north. Excuse me. Perhaps they made the trek in search of better game. In the Piedmont, they flourished, multiplied, and remained until just prior to the arrival of the first European settlers. Although in the James River Valley, right above the falls, as we talked about for a moment, there was a short period of mutual occupation. So think about this for a moment. The Powhatan, the largest single confederation, they're Algonquin Indians. The Monacan and the Manahoacs to the north, which many people believe were allied together against the Powhatan, were Sioux Indians. They don't even speak the same language, and maybe that had something to do with all the warfare between the two of them. This last notion, the idea that the Monacan people had left just prior to the European arrival, is backed up by a very simple fact. In our region of Central Virginia, for example, and this is me writing, in our region, according to historian John Hammond Moore, the absence of lyrical Indian words within Albemarle's boundaries reinforces the belief that the native inhabitants had departed when the first white settlers appeared. With no aboriginals in residence, the frontiersmen obviously had no way of learning what the Indian had called the various hills, streams, and rivers which dot the countryside. Now, let me make this point incredibly plain. Here's something else that's really amazing. Think by comparison of all the Powhatan names that we have in Virginia, and the only Monacan name that I'm aware of is Manacan, which still exists, right? So one name, okay. Here are the more common Powhatan names. Accomack, Appomattox, Chesapeake, Chickahominy, Mattaponi, Nansemond, right, one of the counties, Pamunkey, Piankatank. All of these are tribes allied with the Powhatan. Potomac itself is a Powhatan, is an Algonquin word. Powhatan, of course, Tappahannock, Rappahannock, and the list goes on and on. All of those names, Powhatan names. Why? Well, because the whites were here and heard the Indians use something that was similar. And of course, we turn everything into an anglicized version of what the Indians were speaking, right? Just as I'm having trouble pronouncing these words here. The Monacans certainly found Central Virginia a veritable land of plenty. The forests were full of deer, bear, and elk. Buffalo were not uncommon, and a buffalo trail wound over the mountains and into the Shenandoah Valley. Flocks of turkeys thronged the woods, and every fall and spring, wild ducks and geese darkened the waters. This according to the first historian of Albemarle County, the Reverend Edgar Woods, in his valuable history. Tradition refers to more than one pigeon roost, listen to this folks, where great limbs of trees were broken down by the countless numbers of that bird. So many pigeons landing on a limb that they would break the limb. Before the construction of dams, fish of the best kind, shad and herring, ascended the water courses. Here's a description of a man, John Lederer, an Englishman, who visited Central Virginia in 1669, the 15th of March, not far from this hill. He's describing a hill. This is west along the Rapidan River. Passing over the south branch of the Rappahannock River, the Rapidan, I was almost swallowed in a quicksand. Great herds of red and fallow deer I saw daily feeding, and on the hillsides, bears crashing mast. And crashing mast is eating nuts. I had to look that up. Like swine. Small leopards I have seen in the woods, but never any lions, though skins are much worn by the Indians. The wolves in these parts are so ravenous that I often in the night feared my horse would be devoured by these. They would gather up and howl so close around him, though tethered to the same tree at whose foot I myself and my native Indian friends lay. But the fires which we made, I suppose, scared them from worrying us all. Beaver and otter I met with at every river that I passed, and the woods are full of gray foxes. It certainly sounds like there's plenty to eat just everywhere, everywhere. This I thought was interesting. This is an account of the Indians on their fire hunt. Listen to this, them hunting. Written by, also by Lederer. At their hunting, they are commonly 200 or 300 together. With the sun rising, they call up one another and go forth, searching after the herd, which when they have found, they environ and circle with many fires. So they locate a herd, then they set fires around the herd. And betwixt the fires, they place themselves, and there take up their stands, making the most terriblest noise that they can. The deer, being thus feared by the fires and their voices, betake them to their heels, in other words, took to their heels, whom they chase so long within that circle that many times they kill 6, 8, 10, or 15 in one morning. Imagine bringing down 15 deer in one hunt. Pretty impressive. The Monacans lived an existence that left few traces, an existence described by a small number of firsthand accounts. Of their original villages, as we mentioned, only Massanequac and Mohemcho were visited by white men. Captain Newport and his men passed through in a 1608 expedition beyond the falls of the James. And a colony of Huguenots, which settled along the James in 1699, as I mentioned, briefly detailed the Indians still in residence. Perhaps the best description of the Monacans, and I thought this was fascinating, came from the hand of Huguenot John Fontaine, who in 1716 toured a Saponi village established outside of Fort Christiana in Brunswick County. It is believed that these people were the direct descendants of the inhabitants of Manasookapanow on the Rivanna. Manasookapanow, according to most sources, had been inexplicably abandoned around the 1670s. What little else we know of the Monacans is based on the assumption that their way of life resembled that of the Powhatans. The Monacan civilization was a simple one. The men made war, fished, and stalked game through the open woods. And I found an amazing account of what Indian warfare was like here in Virginia. In large-scale attacks, the Indians use either a square order or else a half-moon formation to surround their enemies. In September 1607, an English party landed at Cacocton and was met by 60 or 70 men, Native Americans, bedecked for war, charging in a square order, singing and dancing out of the woods, with the image of their god Okeus born before them. So all formed in a square, and the person in the front holding up Okeus. The English dispersed them with musket fire. The only detailed account of the half moon in use comes from a mock battle staged for English visitors at Mataponi in 1607. I thought this was fascinating. About 200 Indians divided themselves into Powhatans and Monacans, thus proving how much they hated each other, right? Each side having a captain or a leader. The two companies lined up at musket range about 600 feet apart. The men arranged themselves in ranks 15 abreast and 4 or 5 yards apart and in diagonal files so that those at the rear could shoot as continually as those in the front. Kind of a smart way. Does everybody follow that description? Kind of a smart way to do war. Messengers from the two sides then met in the middle to agree upon the conditions. They're going to have this mock battle. That whosoever were vanquished, such as escape upon their submission in 2 days after, should lie, but their wives and children should be prize for the conquerors. So it was a mock battle, but the losers were going to give up their wives and children. The two companies then moved closer in a series of leaps, while a sergeant on each flank, and of course this is an Englishman saying, this is the sergeant, right, to the Englishman, on each flank and in the rear, an officer for lieutenant kept the men in formation. The leaping men, who were garishly painted and singing and screeching in falsetto, were a formidable spectacle. The men shot off their arrows, after which they joined in hand-to-hand fighting, charging and retiring, every rank seconding, moving with the other. Any man who could flung an enemy to the ground by his hair and went through the motions of clubbing him to death. The slain man was then out, and the killer retired to the rear of his company to give his other fellows a chance. How sporting of them, huh? Soon the Monacan ranks had decreased enough that the Powhatans tried to outflank them by charging in the form of a half moon. The Monacans foiled the attempt by fleeing all in a troop to an area in the woods where their Confederates were lying in ambush. The Powhatans sensed the trap in time and promptly retired to the spot where their own ambush had been laid. Ah, we're not falling for that ambush. We're going to set up our own ambush. Seeing them go, the Monacans took the opportunity to vanish in the woods. One suspects that this outcome had been prearranged. I thought that was great. The Englishman wrote that. So they weren't really going to all kill each other. Because the Monacan maintained no herds or flocks, their hunters raged over a wide area in search of meat. Deer was their favorite. Bears were also killed for meat after they had fattened up for their winter sleep. Their grease was used for butter, lard, and as a base for the paints the Indian used to decorate themselves. You can imagine what that must have smelled like, right? When the nearby wildlife was depleted, the Monacan huntsmen often followed the bison over the Quirank, over the Blue Ridge Mountains, and into the Great Valley beyond. The Monacans were adept fishermen, as were the other eastern woodland tribes, and frequently built river weirs or dams in order to gather fish in their cleverly placed woven baskets. Monacan women worked as gardeners. Of the vegetables they cultivated, Jefferson named at least 4 in his notes on the state of Virginia: pumpkins, squash, corn, and long or sweet potatoes. Corn was so highly prized by the Monacans that it was considered sacred. One of their favorite trading items, in fact, was a clay pot filled with the golden kernels. Corn and beans they planted together in the same hole. As the corn stalks sprouted up, they provided the runners for the bean vines to climb. Young Indians were often posted on raised platforms amongst the corn plants to serve as scarecrows. So they're getting some use out of the young kids, right? Ironically, it seems that some Monacan villages resembled the palisaded forts erected by the white-skinned colonists. According to John Fontaine, so now I'm going to get to a section written by Fontaine. Remember, he visited a Saponi town, and the Saponi tribe is allied and is a contributor tribe to the Monacan Nation. He visited them in Brunswick County. According to John Fontaine, the Saponi village he visited was constructed right alongside a river. The houses join all the same to one another, and all together make a circle. So that is, the back end of the houses were joined, and that way they formed a palisade. He wrote, "The walls are made up of large pieces of timber, which are squared, and being sharpened at the lower end, are put down 2 feet in the ground and stand about 7 feet high. These posts are laid as close together as possible, and when they are all fixed after this manner, they make a roof with rafters and cover the house with oak or hickory bark, which they strip off in great flakes and lay it so closely together that no rain can come in." Other Monacan shelters were described as being circular, made up of a framework of flexible saplings with both ends in the ground, the whole covered with bark or grass mats. Across the entranceway would be hung a deerskin. These houses would certainly have been dark and very smoky affairs. One portal only provided the light. One hole in the roof, the only escape for the smoke. "They make their fires always in the middle of the house," wrote Fontaine. "The chief of their household goods is a pot and some wooden dishes and trays, which they make themselves. They seldom have anything to sit upon, but squat upon the ground. They have small divisions in their houses to sleep in, which they make of mats made of bulrushes. They have bedsteads raised about 2 feet from the ground, upon which they lay bear and deer skins, and all the covering they have is a single blanket. These people have no sort of tame creatures, but live entirely upon their hunting and the corn which their wives cultivate. They live as," this is Fontaine speaking, remember, "they live as lazily and miserably as any people in the world." That's an Englishman speaking. Fortunately, Fontaine also described the appearance of the Monacans at Fort Christiana. "For their war dress, the young men of the tribe decorated themselves with feathers in their hair and run through their ears." And we heard that description of the other man who had a tuft of feathers behind his ears. "Their faces painted with blue and vermilion, their hair cut in many forms, some on one side of the head, some on both, and others on the upper part of the head, making it stand like a cock's comb. These proud warriors, wrapped in blue and red blankets, strutted back and forth in their abominable dress, looking for all the world, according to Fontaine, like so many furies. The Monacan women at Fort Christiana had long, straight black hair reaching down to their waists. They used nothing to cover their upper bodies, but each of them wore, according to Fontaine, a blanket tied round the waist and hanging down about the legs like a petticoat. These women were wild-looking and very shy around Europeans. But despite the fact that they were covered head to toe in horrible-smelling bear grease," think of this, what this must have portrayed Fontaine. "Fontaine found them straight and well-limbed, with good shape and extraordinary good features. Fontaine claimed that these Monacans lived a monogamous life, that is, until the woman could no longer bear children. Then the man, according to Fontaine, may take another wife, but is obliged to keep both and maintain both of them." So if one wife can no longer have children, he can take another, but he still has to keep that first wife. "These descriptions are fascinating in that they detail a people but a few generations away from the inhabitants of Manasukapanow in Albemarle County. Archaeologist David Bushnell, Jr., writing in the 1920s, called Manasukapanow an extensive village on the banks of the Rivanna, directly north of the University of Virginia and about 1 mile up the river from the bridge of the Southern Railway. This site is almost exactly 2 miles upstream from the river's main branch." So here's Manasukapanow. Here's Charlottesville, UVA, almost directly north of the University of Virginia, about 2 miles up from its principal branch along the South Fork of the Rivanna River. Just to the west of the town's location, the beautiful Rivanna takes a broad loop to the south, then continues in a southeasterly direction. The land here comprises a fertile river plain, more open along the south or right bank. And in fact, that area, if you think about it, is directly behind Dunlora. Over there at the polo grounds, right, except that the town, Montecuccino, was on both sides of the Rivanna River, right. The village appears to have occupied both sides of the river, wrote Bushnell, with a ford that made it possible to pass from one side to the other, although canoes were probably in constant use on the Rivanna. The exact translation of Montecuccino has not been determined, but it may be possible to decipher sections of the word separately. So this is me attempting to do this. In 1728, for example, William Byrd wrote of a ford on the Roanoke River in North Carolina called by the Saponi Indians Monaseep, which signifies, in their jargon, shallow water. As Moni or Mana, M-O-N-I or M-O-N-A, appear in many of their names for creeks, crossings, and villages near shallows, as in Monahassanu and Montecuccino, the two-syllable prefix may indeed have meant ford. James Mooney, an early expert on the language spoken by the Siouan tribes in the East, believed that Succipino was probably the original of Saponi. So the origin of Saponi came from Succipino. Thus, perhaps, and this is me guessing, Montecuccino could be translated as Saponi people of the ford, or simply Saponi ford. The sage of Monticello was also fascinated by Indian languages, Thomas Jefferson, as you know. He regretted that we have suffered so many of the Indian tribes already to extinguish without having previously collected and deposited in the records of literature the general rudiments, at least, of the languages they spoke. He, too, was interested in the early people of Albemarle County and made a personal investigation of the great burial mound that sat near Montecuccino. And his careful analysis of this barrow, this mound, in fact, won for him the title Father of Modern Archaeology. So think about this just for a moment. I haven't told anybody this, but I have a book proposal that I'm working on to write about this. But modern archaeology as we know it, began in one afternoon right here in Albemarle County, archaeology. The mound, this is according to Jefferson, was situated on the low grounds of the Rivanna and opposite to some hills on which had been an Indian town, wrote Jefferson. It was of spheroidal form, of about 40 feet diameter at the base, and had been of about 12 feet altitude, though now reduced by the plow to 7.5, having been under cultivation about a dozen years. What a shame that they reduced it with the plow. Round the base was an excavation of 5 feet depth and width, from whence the earth had been taken, of which the hillock was formed. I first dug superficially in several parts of it. And let me say right here, when Jefferson says, I first dug, he meant my slaves first dug superficially in several parts of it and came to collections of human bones at different depths, from 6 inches to 3 feet below the surface. Jefferson's systematic dig revealed about 1,000 skeletons arranged in rough layers with no apparent plan. The bones did not seem to show wounds acquired in battle, and he did not believe that the barrow was simply Montecuccino's common sepulcher. Jefferson thought it obvious that the first collection had been deposited on the surface of the earth, a few stones put over it, then a covering of earth, that the second had been laid on this, had covered more or less of it in proportion to the number of bones, and then was also covered with earth and so on. In other words, you lay out a few bodies, you put stones on top of those, then earth, some more bodies, stones, earth, more bodies. After hundreds of years, you end up with a mound this way. Since the tall mass of dirt and stones contained so many bodies, was it, for a time, the main burial mound for the northern part of the Monacan Nation? There is evidence that it was revered and long remembered by the Indians. Writing in 1781, Jefferson recalled a party passing about 30 years ago, in other words, 1750, through the part of the country where this barrow is. went through the woods directly to it without any instructions or inquiry, and having stayed about it sometime with expressions which were construed to be those of sorrow, they returned to the high road and pursued their journey. Bushnell concluded that only those who had retained a memory of the burial place could or would have made such a pilgrimage. And I thought it was fascinating, just discovered the other day, there were other mounds in this area of Central Virginia and other pilgrimages. Listen to this one. Now, this was written in 1914 by David Bushnell, and Bushnell, who I quote a lot in here, was down here on behalf of the Smithsonian Institution investigating the burial mound and Jefferson's dig. But he went out to Bath County, which is in the western part of Virginia, and he interviewed this gentleman, and they had mounds over there too. Some years since, Colonel Adam Dickinson, who then owned and lived on the land, in a conversation I had with him, related to me that many years before that time, in other words, we're going back into the 1800s, as he was sitting in his porch one afternoon, his attention was arrested by a company of strange-looking men coming up the bottomlands of the river. They seemed to him to be in quest of something, when all at once they made a sudden turn and went straight to the burial mound. He saw them walking over it and round, seeming to be engaged in earnest talk. The company, I think he told me, consisted of 10 or 12 Indians, all young men except one, who seemed to be borne down with extremes of old age. By signs, they asked for something to eat, which was soon given them, after which they immediately departed. Unfortunately, Colonel Dickinson didn't think to ask them, what tribe are you a part of? What language do you speak? Where did you come from to visit this burial mound? What a darn shame. But the implication is clear. It's really similar to the description that Jefferson used. Why was Montasuca Pinal abandoned? We may never know. But we do know something of the sad fate of the once powerful Monacan nation. Prior to the arrival of the first white-skinned settlers in the westernmost regions of the Piedmont, which took place in approximately the 1720s, the Confederacy of Monacans, Saponi, and Tutelo felt it necessary to remove their villages to the southwest. They may have been anticipating the hostilities that would have erupted between themselves and the Europeans, or, more likely, they may have been forced out by Iroquois attacks from the north. Fontaine wrote in 1716 that the destructive forays by bands from the Five Nations of New York had kept the Virginia Indians in an uproar for more than a century. In western North Carolina, along the Virginia border, say most of the sources, the Monacans were assimilated by the Tuscarora. Ironically, these people later moved north and were received in 1712 as the Sixth Nation. During the American Revolution, unfortunately, several of these tribes sided with the British. For this reason, George Washington dispatched General John Sullivan with order that the territory occupied by these Indians was totally destroyed. 40 villages were put to the torch, and undoubtedly, some of these may have contained remnants of the Monacan nation. Today, there are approximately 700 members of the Monacan tribe. Most live outside of the state of Virginia. A large number, however, reside in Amherst County at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains. David Bushnell wrote in 1914 that these people were still speaking a language that contained many Indian words. Sadly, up to that time, 1914, nobody had seen fit to record these words. While these people may represent the last remnants of various tribes, he lamented, it is highly probable that among them are living the last of the Monacan. The Monacan culture left next to nothing in its wake. Their dwellings required but a few indentations in the ground. Their implements are often difficult to distinguish from the stones they were made of, the stones among which they still lie along our creeks and riverbeds. Of their cultivation, we have no trace. What is left to us is a dim understanding of the once proud people who ruled the territory overseen by the mountains Quirank when it was still in its natural, untouched state. Long before the Piedmont stump-studded fields rang with the sounds of the white man's axe, the forest primeval was the domain of the Monacan. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.